Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
In March 1945, a British soldier, Major Tom Harrison, and 42 Australian, New Zealand and British guerrillas dropped by parachute into the jungle behind enemy lines in Borneo. They landed in the jungle highlands, some of them in trees, and rapidly managed to recruit hundreds to the cause of fighting the Japanese. Their mission was to support the AIF landings on the coast, the largest amphibious operation in Australian history. Over the next few months, the guerrillas roamed at will. They tried to live off the land and were very, very successful. They eventually killed over 1,000 enemy soldiers, forced the surrender of the last renegade company of Japanese who remained after the ceasefire as well. Harrison himself was a unique figure, although many of his men hated him and some even made quite detailed plans to kill him. That didn't happen. Paul Malone's written about the operation in his book Kill the Major, in which he recounts too the harrowing stories of the operation and those who took part in it. He joins us this evening. Paul, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Philip, what I aim to do in this was tell it like the soldiers felt it, or the guerrillas felt it. It's not a military story in the sense of the manoeuvres here and there, but really one of the things I wanted to get across was what individuals felt and experienced. And so, as you say, first of all, four people flew into the Highlands, Harrison and five altogether. Harrison.
You told me that. Can we start with this, though? Who was Harrison anyway? He's a British soldier, although he doesn't really have much soldiering experience, actually, does he, by this stage? But who was he?
Look, he was an eccentric character, very much in the British tradition. He was born in Argentina, but he was the son of a brigadier general, a British brigadier general, and he came back and lived in England. He started, as a student at university, he did odd things like walking into town from Oxford in bare feet with his toenails painted bright pink. Something that maybe today wouldn't be thought of as so unique in Australia, but at the time was really very odd. He then went on to go off on various expeditions. He actually led one to Borneo in 1932.
But this was as an ornithologist, wasn't it?
Yes, as an ornithologist, because as a schoolboy, he'd actually recruited people to study birds and had written a book. He was quite an extraordinary character. But he'd also managed to make it to Lapland in another expedition and to the New Hebrides in a third expedition. So he really got around and he finally had, before the war, set up a thing called mass observation, which was one of those, probably the first in the world, to try and find out what ordinary people thought about events. He had a host of people surveying and observing people all around the country and telling and publishing accounts of what people in Britain thought.
He was, as you say, an eccentric figure in the British tradition and full of all sorts of unexpected skills. Anyway, the war comes, he offers himself for recruitment, he becomes an officer. Because he knows something about Borneo, this is how his name comes up for this operation, isn't it? They decide to drop this force into the Borneo Highlands, even though no one's ever been there, so they don't know what to expect, do they?
Initially, they wanted to go have a submarine landing on the coast, and they realised there were all sorts of problems with that, not least that the submarine couldn't get very close to the coast, but also that they weren't sure that the natives, Malays and Chinese, would be able to assist them because, let's face it, they were under occupation. So Harrison himself had this idea of going into the jungle and parachuting in. Two of the other majors who were recruited to the operation, Carter and Sochan, both were more inclined to go for the submarine, but they couldn't really prove up the concept. Harrison managed to sort of convince authorities to let him get on an American Liberator, and which was flying over Japanese lines, and have a look. And he knew from his research that there were these people called the Calabit, and they lived up in the highlands. And keep in mind, at the time, Borneo was heavy jungle, with trees literally 50 meters high. And when you went inland, people were along the rivers and they practiced Sweden agriculture. They cut down trees and burnt them and grew rice. But they grew rice on these hillsides. But inland, there were Harrison knew there were these people who practiced wet rice cultivation, as you would see in Bali or in China. So there was clearings. And he believed that he could parachute into the highlands and recruit these people. But he didn't know how they would receive him, because keep in mind that the various people were had been headhunters and there'd been very little contact with the Kalabut.
Exactly. They were quite they were thought to be quite aggressive people. and there were headhunters, as you say, and the taking of heads was still being practiced. And so, I mean, it was an act of quite some daring, really, to jump out of an aeroplane. He hadn't done that very much either. In fact, some of his party had never done it at all.
That's right.
This was their first parachute jump, to jump out through the clouds, landing into a paddy field in the middle of, you know, deepest, darkest morning. They must have thought that they weren't coming back alive, did they?
Most of them. In fact, that was what they were told, that that they probably wouldn't come back alive, but if they were lucky, 50% of them would.
Mm.
And I should say that the British authorities had outlawed headhunting. So technically, headhunting had ended. And the Rajas, what were called the White Rajas, the Brooke family that ruled Sarawak, the area where they were going in, had tried. The one thing they basically said was, listen, you guys, you tribal people, you can do whatever you like as long as you don't engage in warfare and don't headhunt. You can have your own religion. You can practice whatever way you want to live, your own authority, but you're not allowed to headhunt. And they had stopped in probably about the 1920s, they'd probably stopped headhunting. So he thought that the Kalabut had stopped headhunting, but he could not be sure.
No.
So,
and in fact, they hadn't.
well, let's put it this way. When they arrived, Harrison dropped in with his four sergeants. Hmm. He was the first to drop in. And he didn't know how he would be received, and people approached him waving what he thought were sticks with little white flags on the top. What had happened was that the people had seen them come in out of the sky and thought that to appease the gods, they would wave these white flags. They thought they were, you know, what would you think? You'd never seen anything like this. But as it turned out, he was brought to the longhouse. The people lived in longhouses.
Yeah.
And the Pengulu, that is the headman, the Pengulu Lawe Basari, welcomed him. He had actually been to the coast. He'd been arrested for murder.
The headman had.
And he'd been brought to the coast, but he'd been treated quite well, and he'd learned to speak Malay. So they were an extraordinary piece of luck that he could actually communicate with them.
Because otherwise, that's right, because they had no language skills, the soldiers, did they? They had no knowledge of the language at all.
No, how could they? With no contact with the club, but how could they speak the language? So, but lo and behold, this man could.
And they could speak some Malay too.
Yes, well, along with Harrison, he had one man called Sanderson who could speak Malay, he himself could speak a bit of Malay, so they could communicate.
And it was quite successful, wasn't it? I mean, very rapidly, the headman agreed and said, particularly he got very excited when Harrison said, well, you know, we'll provide arms, and they very rapidly recruited quite a few people of surrounding tribes people to join them. And they were quite successful, weren't they? Although the men were basically told by Harrison to live off the land, because the food supply issue was a critical one. They never dropped much food to them, and this became a big issue with the men, didn't they? Who found living off the land a rather problematic experience.
Yes, look, Harrison, I think you know, he was a character, as we say, and I don't think he fully appreciated the difficulties of the people he sent out. Mind you, I should say also that he himself walked through the jungle along these paths.
Yeah.
And, you know, having done it myself, I can tell you that when you go walking there, you will be covered with leeches in a matter of hours. You know, if you walk for 2 or 3 hours through the jungle and pours rain, you get maybe 20 or 30 leeches on you. That's not a problem in itself. You just bleed a lot, but they very quickly become infected.
Mm.
And so that's one thing, and they turn into tropical sores. But also, as you say, the idea that, he said, Harrison took the view that if you can't convince the local tribes people to support you and feed you, then, you know, you're not going to stand a chance. You're going to die anyway. So you must be able to convince them. But he didn't realize that some of these people, some of these villagers were, stuck to find food themselves.
Yeah.
The war had disrupted them. The Japanese had requisitioned and forced them. The one thing the Japanese did do was send patrols upriver and requisition rice and other food.
Yeah.
So these people weren't flush with food.
Yeah, I know. The conditions that these men are fighting in is just quite unbelievable. They're very successful, and I must say in advance that all of them survived, astonishingly. Although, as I say, a number of them had deep animosity towards Harrison, particularly Ronald Griffiths March, who while sitting, his men had basically tied him onto a latrine because he was suffering amoebic dysentery. He basically thought his end had come. But one of the things he did vow to do was, because of his animus towards Harrison, was to kill him. And he knew he was turning up, so he oiled up a captured Japanese pistol that he had, made sure it was working, loosed off a couple of rounds to see that it still worked, kept it handy and waited for Harrison to come. He thought he'll shoot him and then he'll pretend that there was an attack and cover it up that way. Fortunately for Harrison, that didn't happen, did it?
Well, look, that's right. You see, he had by then, he'd been starving. He'd confronted Japanese. His people had taken heads and so on. And he had amoebic dysentery. So he was, he was literally lashed to what they called a sit toilet. He was over a hole and he was just going whenever he needed. And he thought, well, Harrison will come. He'd been told that Harrison was going to come in a few days. Mm. And this was in August. And so on the about the 13th of August, I think it was, he was prepared for Harrison's arrival with, say, the Nambu pistol, and he was going to shoot Harrison and dump him in the jamban, the hole, and then he would fire off, or he would throw in the Japanese pistol, fire off his own gun, and say that Harrison had been shot by a Japanese. But it never happened because, unbelievably, on the 13th of August, Harrison got a message saying, and he actually has uncharacteristically, very clearly printed in his diary. You can see on the National Archives website this page that says, I've got a message that the Japanese are going to surrender. And so Harrison, instead of going to visit Griffiths Marsh, went back downriver, and Griffiths Marsh lived to... never became a murderer.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Exactly. With the standards of today, would you say that they committed a number of atrocities?
Look.
With the standards of today, I'm saying.
Look, with the standards of today, you must say that they did. There is a story I tell of Driver Henry.
Yeah.
Now, what happened was the overall landing was to take place. Operation Oboe was the biggest landing, as you said earlier. 75,000 Australian troops were to land at three places, at Tarakan, at Brunei Bay, and at Balikpapan. And the guerrillas dropped in, these particular guerrillas dropped in on the 25th of March and weren't in time to help at Tarakan. But by the time the Brunei Bay landing happened, they were. And so on the 9th and 10th of March, they started attacking the Japanese posts and ambushing Japanese close to the coast. And the AIF came up the river and shortly afterwards, and they confronted a man called Driver Phil Henry, now the lowest of the low ranking. Mm. But Driver Phil Henry, by then, his men had taken many heads and they commanded the Limbang River, along with a Sergeant Fred Sanderson and his men. And Henry had taken a couple of collaborators captive. And up the river came these officers and men on barges. And there's Henry lolling around in beads and bare feet. And, and he didn't apparently pay much respect to the officers. And they apparently didn't pay much respect to him and or his IBAN. Anyway, one of the collaborators was apparently very much a collaborator. Generally speaking, they didn't worry too much about people because they understood that, you know, they're under the thumb of the Japanese. The officers went off to inspect the little town of Wukong, and Henry took care himself of getting billets for the men. But suddenly there's a commotion, and the officers hear a shot and rush back, and there is a body lying on the ground, beheaded. The officers realize that the IBAN, Henry's troops, have beheaded one of the collaborators. So Henry realizes that he's in a bit of trouble here. So he fires off a note that night to Harrison up at the headquarters way up in the mountains, signals to them via radio that effectively, look, unfortunately, we had a very dangerous collaborator here. I know your orders weren't that we were not to headhunt, but unfortunately, you know, my men have beheaded this man. And Henry is arrested and taken downriver, much to the shock of his IBAN warriors. What? Why have they taken Henry? You know, we've been fighting Japanese, and their attitude was, well, look, you know, you guys, you AIF guys and all your clean shirts and so on, you just give us the guns and you go home because you're not doing anything and we've already won this war. Anyway, Henry is put under arrest, and Wooten, who was a lawyer, and you mentioned, you know, the rules of today, Wooten followed the absolute proper procedures of the time. Under the laws of war of the day, you were not to kill you were not to kill captives. You know, he was a man who was a captive, and he ordered a court martial, and Henry was duly brought before the court, and Bradshaw, one of the officers, testified that what happened effectively, a man had been beheaded, and meanwhile, Harrison also gave evidence, the major commanding Henry, and he basically said, look, you know, there's special circumstances. He could not possibly have kept this man. You know, he would have betrayed them and given away the positions and things like that. And so he gave evidence in his behalf. But he also signaled to Blamey, overall commander. And Blamey fired back a note to General Wooten saying, listen, don't do anything with Henry until I've seen the full transcript of the court-martial. And when he did that, he sent back an officer. And basically the officer was under instructions, get Henry the hell out of control of the courts. And Henry was duly whisked back to Australia. And apparently, according to notes that are on the in the records in the War Memorial, he became a pillar of society and...
It's very hard to judge it from the standards of today, because the conditions these men were fighting in were just quite appalling. And as I said, they were very successful, and despite the animus of Harrison, Harrison does seem like a highly divisive figure, doesn't he? He's
definitely,
you know, his attitude towards women is pretty appalling. His attitude towards women is appalling. What happens to him in the end after the war? Just briefly, because we're running out of time here, but just briefly.
Could I just say one thing further about that incident? Yeah. Keep in mind that the Japanese also didn't take prisoners either.
Oh, no, of course not.
So I just want to say that. Yeah. But yes, in relation to Henry, there's one other thing that Henry was also, Harrison was also loyal to his people. And the AIF wanted to pull out on the, you know, after the 15th of August Japanese surrender, the AIF wanted to pull out. And Harrison said, now, hold on a minute. Two Japanese companies are now roaming inland, killing the villagers who have supported us and pillaging their villages and so on. So Harrison mounted a case and recruited three men. And, of course, his troops readily rejoined him. And he came up river, and his second in charge up in the highlands, Bartram, mounted ambushes, and eventually they forced the surrender of those two Japanese companies on the 31st of October. That is 2.5 months after the official war's end.
Yeah.
600 men who had been roaming as two companies inland finally surrendered to Harrison. But look, going back to Harrison, he was a very, very you know, divisive man. He was obviously harsh on his men. And of course, there may have been some differences in attitudes, him being a British officer and them being knockabout Australians and New Zealanders.
Yeah, the condition of some of the men, I mean, the illnesses they suffered and the condition they were in when they were pulled out of the thing is quite harrowing to read. Anyway, they all did survive, including Harrison, actually, who didn't, I think, die until the 70s, wasn't it, when he died in a traffic accident in Thailand?
Yes, he died in a traffic accident in Thailand, but he also did some remarkable things, you know, after that. I mean, he and his wife discovered the deep skull in the Naya caves in Borneo. Yeah. He was the first person to suggest that turtles should be tagged to see how long it was before they came back. He did a lot of extraordinary things.
Yeah, he was, that's right, you say. He was an extraordinary man. All right. Look, the book is it's very interesting. It's called Kill the Major, the true story of the most successful Allied guerrilla war in Borneo. The author's Paul Malone, who's been our guest tonight, and it's a fascinating tale. Paul, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.